Hello and welcome to Martian Driving Podcast 142. My name's Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing a movie from 1965 and a movie from 2018. The movie from 1965 is Invasion, starring Edward Judd, a very small scale and kind of interesting British science fiction film. Then we go to 2018 for a Netflix movie, Anon, directed by Andrew Niccol, who directed Gattaca, and starring Clive Owen and Amanda Seyfried, which has got some interesting things to say about privacy in the age of the internet. So get your snacks ready, and I will get the contact details out of the way and then start talking about the two films. Martian Drive-In Podcast happens every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, fantasy, and horror appreciation. Sometimes I have guests in, sometimes I'll have a round table. Sometimes it's just random, particularly when there's a Netflix Marvel Cinematic Universe thing coming up. Feedback is the bread and butter of podcasting, so you can put feedback through at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also email feedback to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com. You can also support the podcast at patreon.com by going to patreon.com/paleocinema. Just be aware when you're listening to the podcast, there may be some naughty words in it. So if there are kids around, you might want to listen to it later on. Okay, so how are you doing? You're looking good. Have you lost weight? Yeah, we've been doing fine here. The weather is warming up, which is kind of cool and interesting. And there have been interesting things happening as well. I'll go into that. One of which kind of directly affects me tangentially, but not in any real terms, and that is there's been a lot of ructions with the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the ABC, with whom every fortnight I go and talk about movies with the wonderful Michaela Simpson for ABC Northern Territory. And I got there just in between the two big things that happened. The first one was that the CEO of the ABC, Michelle Guthrie, got the sack from the board, sacked her, which was a bit of a shock. She wasn't popular, and I don't think she did the gig in the manner in which they expected her to. And then after a whole bunch of other revelations came out, the chairman of the board of the ABC, a guy called Justin Milne, quit today because his position, as they say, was untenable. And there was a lot of things about political interference that he permitted to happen in the ABC, particularly regarding political journalism. The ABC is supposed to be neutral. It's supposed to speak truth to power. It's basically owned by the people of Australia. And our current federal government has acted like it was their private little mouthpiece, let's say. And that isn't the case. And 75% of Australians watch the ABC every week, or listen to it on the radio, or listen to it on podcasts, or listen to it on a streaming service. It's a national institution of which we are incredibly fond, and which is somewhat unlike anything else in the world. Even the BBC is not quite the same as the ABC. But, yeah, so there have been these ructions. And the day, Wednesday, when I do the radio gig, I go down to South Bank Studios and talk to Michaela, was in between those two things. I did see, and this was a bit of a wonderful thing, sitting near us in the upstairs area where there's a lounge while we're waiting to go into the booth, while I'm waiting to go into the booth, was Barry Cassidy, the political correspondent who does a political show on Sunday mornings called Insiders. He was sitting on the couch not too far away, working on some stuff on a tablet and making some notes and things, and not looking very happy at all. Big buzz just seeing him, because I got a lot of respect from him as a political journalist. He's an incredibly savvy analyst, and there's nobody really, who would I compare him to in other parts of the world? Maybe Walter Cronkite in America. He is a big deal. And it was kind of cool to see Barry sitting there, even though the circumstances were kind of stressful, because the organisation for which he worked was under threat because of the political machinations. The government was keeping silent and taking a fairly low profile on this while it all worked itself out. And, yeah, it's interesting times. So they've got to find a new CEO and a new chairman of the board, or chairperson of the board, for the ABC, which hopefully I wish them well with. I think it's put a bit of air onto the wounds and cut the old scabs off, and hopefully something good will come of it. So, yeah, that's been happening, and I've been following that assiduously, as I do with any kind of interesting crisis around. I put out another YouTube video as well about going to a trash and treasure market up in Ballarat on last weekend when it was really cold and wet and miserable. And one of the things with the YouTube videos is when I do one of these ones where I travel afar and do some shooting of video and try to kind of make it funny and amusing and stuff like that, it fails. Not the video, yeah, the recording of the video and the editing of the video and that kind of stuff. But whatever I set out to do there kind of fails. I didn't pick up much stuff in Ballarat. I got wet. I got there way too early to the market, which is something I'm prone to do. And I went to a few other places that were kind of interesting, and I took a little bit of interesting video. But because it was so dark and cloudy, one of the problems is I don't get that eye-popping colour you get in a lot of other videos, and which will come with summertime and sunny days. You get much more vivid colours. So I did that, which was kind of fun. But I come to running to a theme with the YouTube videos of travelling and then failure. Hopefully that won't happen when we go to Japan next year, because that'll be along. But when I do the solo drives and the solo trips, it kind of goes a bit funny. But so I did that. Tomorrow's a public holiday in Melbourne because there's a football game the day after, and the state government, for reasons best known to who the fuck knows, decided to have a public holiday the day before the Australian Football League Grand Final in Aussie rules. And so Melbourne gets a public holiday, which doesn't affect me too much because I'm not working. But it does mean that there are a lot more people around annoying me when I go out in public by basically being around and driving badly and all those other kind of things that annoy us on a day-to-day basis. And it's also school holidays, which makes it worse. So what I'm going to do is hunker down for the next couple of days. I've got tons of food. We've been to Costco and stocked up on all sorts of weird and wonderful bits of food. So the next few days, I'm just going to kind of withdraw into our shell, watch some videos, maybe put out another YouTube video and this podcast, of course, and just kind of get away from the insanity that happens this time of year in Melbourne. You guys have no idea how tribal and ubiquitous thing the grand final week is in Melbourne. It's just totally weird. And coming from Sydney and not being particularly into sport, it's one of those things where you kind of go, okay, well, you guys are doing that thing. You guys are there doing the four legs bad, two legs good stuff. I've actually been to one AFL game. I got taken there on a date with somebody back in the day in a corporate box, which is one of those glassed-in boxes way above the game. And, yeah, it was a really weird thing. It was like being in a glass box just above the island of Dr. Moreau. There were some seriously bestial activities going on in the crowd, and the yelling and the hatred and the nastiness really isn't my kind of thing. But it'll pass, and then everybody will get sad, and in about 4 months' time they'll start the whole fucking thing again. But yes, I'm going to dodge that one very, very nicely, hopefully. So on to what I've been watching. I have been watching a few things. I did see a low-budget thing. I'm not sure whether it was on Amazon Prime or on Netflix. It was on one of the two. A movie called Shelter, which is about six people who get trapped in an underground fallout shelter in what they first think is a nuclear attack. And they stay there for months and months. There's food, there's water, there's disposal of stuff, and they all go insane and things don't end well for them. It's a kind of low budget thing. It doesn't commit fully to its premise, and it doesn't kind of go full on, and it's kind of a little bit like a lot of other small films of the sort that I've seen. It's got quite a nasty ending with a few implications in it, but I wouldn't bother, to be really honest with you. I did see the live action version on Netflix, it was, of an anime and manga called Bleach, which is worth looking at. It's basically the story of a guy who's spiritually powerful, a teenager in high school, who gets attacked by a demon, and a young girl, who is also a demon hunter, goes to his rescue, and during the altercations, she gives him her power so that he can defeat the demon, and he ends up having all of her supernatural demon fighting powers, while she has to deal with the political repercussions in the demon hunting community of having done that. It's got some really nice special effects work with the demons, and they don't look like demons do in most movies and most TV shows. They are quite interesting and also quite Japanese in their styling. It was fun. It was, you know, a good solid action film. I probably should go and check out some of the manga and some of the anime versions of it at some stage. But it was a nice little kind of slightly different, not kind of 100% wonderful, but worthwhile watching, Bleach. So I enjoyed that. Then I've seen a couple of movies that I'm probably going to do for the next Paleo Cinema podcast. I'm ahead of it on that one, so that's a good thing. Finian's Rainbow, one of the three musicals, well, three musically based movies, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. It's the first one he did in 1968, starring Fred Astaire, Petula Clark, Don Franks, and Al Freeman Jr. It's based on a 1948 slightly socialist musical, Finian's Rainbow, about a man who steals a leprechaun's pot of gold and takes it to an idealistic little community in California. I kind of like it. I watched it a few years ago and didn't like it at all. But I watched it this time, maybe with my eyes a little wide open. And it's got a charm. I'm not going to talk too much about it now because I'm going to save all of that fuel for next week when I do it on the podcast. But it's better than I expected it to be. And it was really nice watching the commentary. There's a little prelude to the commentary, which Francis Ford Coppola did about 10 years ago for the movie. And he talks about, you know, his insecurities and his uncertainties and what he would have changed and what went wrong and all of those kind of things, which is very interesting. There are some other things. There are some of the choices he made or would have liked to have gotten his viewpoint on, but he was differently inclined. But it's a nice commentary track. I picked this up fairly cheaply, I think last time I was in Sydney, in fact. And it's better than I remembered it being, so that's kind of good. It's got some problems, but I did enjoy Finian's Rainbow. And then I watched a 1943 American musical, Cabin in the Sky, which stars Eddie Rochester Anderson, Ethel Waters, and a few other very, very interesting black actors. It's a dated thing in a lot of ways, and it does have some stereotypical stuff, but it also has some really interesting bits and pieces, and it has a certain charm about it that I really enjoy. I saw a very, very small English film, 59 minutes long, so it's not long at all, called Where Has Poor Mickey Gone? It's really hard to find. You may well find it on some of the invite-only torrent sites, which is where I got it. And it's about a bunch of kind of thugs in 1960s London who find, who break into the business of a guy who makes magic tricks for magicians and things, played by Warren Mitchell, good character actor. And things aren't what they seem to be. It's a little bit like an Amicus horror episode. It's a little bit like a Twilight Zone thing or a Night Gallery episode, done on a very low budget. But it does have a certain spookiness about it, which kind of worked. At 59 minutes, it's not going to be using up your time particularly badly. But Where Has Poor Mickey Gone? I think it needs a release of some sort on disc or on a streaming service, because I think it's got enough there to make it worth watching. The other thing is, I've just started watching this, I haven't finished it yet, is I'm re-watching Sonny Chiba's The Street Fighter, because it's a Sonny Chiba karate movie, which is all you have to say, really. And it's the best Sonny Chiba karate movie. If you have one that you think's better, let me know and I'll take a look at it. But I'm probably going to go through the Street Fighter movies, amongst other things, soon, and just enjoy them all again. So that's about it for what I've been doing and watching and thinking about. I'll take a break now, and then when I come back, I'll look at the 1965 English science fiction movie Invasion, starring Edward Judd.
A man and woman drive along a lonely country road at night. Suddenly, their headlights pick up a strange figure. From this moment on, nothing is quite the same again.
Any sign of a fracture?
No, not at all.
Good.
But there's a radio-opaque disc inside his brain.
He's not human.
Well, we think that a rocket touched down here. It was atomic-powered, and that's why we're picking up the radioactivity now.
Who are they? What are they? Where do they come from? What do they want?
We're just going to sit here and boil to death?
Well, what? Commit suicide like Carter?
Escape. Escape. Away from the heat. Away from the terror. But where do you go? The invasion is on. The invaders are here. They can destroy you. But they are indestructible. Trapped. No way out but death. The invasion is on. The invaders are here. An enemy like nothing on Earth. Their secret weapon, stark, stifling terror.
Sister, what happened?
Took Dr. Harland with him.
When?
A few seconds ago.
The invasion is on. The invaders are here.
The outside lines are out of order.
All of them?
Yes, apparently we're cut off.
We can sometimes forget when we're watching big-budget action films from the 21st century how there can be a lot of fun in a small-budget movie with a contained space and some decent character act. Episodic television does that quite well in some cases, but as far as a feature film is concerned, we don't see very much of it these days. Though the streaming platforms does give us some hope that kind of small-scale but cool stories can be told, and that we will get to enjoy them that way. The 1965, though Wikipedia says 1966, British science fiction movie Invasion is kind of like that. It's a small budget film with only a few different locations in it. It's filmed at night so that they had use of certain facilities, including a hospital, which is the main place where the events of the invasion take place. And they take the opportunity to think laterally about the idea of a humanoid invasion from space. It isn't really an invasion as much as it's a kind of police action. People from outer space hunting down a fugitive. Now, the movie does take a couple of opportunities to kind of boost the weirdness of it. For a start, the aliens, who are called Listerians, look East Asian. So they're not the usual kind of aliens from outer space that we got in this kind of film, where they're played by Caucasian people with an English accent. They actually look like East Asians and are played by East Asian actors. Or I should be more correct and say people of East Asian extraction, because the main female alien in the movie is played by an actress called Yoko Tani. Interesting thing about her is she was born in Paris in 1928. Worked as a dancer in Paris and then moved over the water to England. Did a lot of episodic television where they required an Asian actor. And in this one, she does have a bit of a thick accent, but it may well be a French accent with Japanese overtones. It's kind of interesting. But she's a different choice there. Now, there is a few other Asian actors in there. There's a guy called Rick Young who plays the male Listerian. And Rick Young, I kind of looked at him in this film and thought, I know this guy. I've seen him in something else. What have I seen him in? In fact, he's done a number of things. He's still, he's not acting at the moment, but he has acted recently. And he was one of the bad guys in the original Transporter movie in 2002 with Statham. He was also in 7 Years in Tibet. He played one of the bad guys in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He was in American Gangster. Let's have a look here. What else was he in? He played Bruce Lee's father in Dragon, the Bruce Lee story. which was kind of an interesting choice. He was actually born in Wandsworth in London. And we also get Tsai Chin, a British-based actor, and she was actually born in Shanghai, but did a lot of things in Britain, particularly during the 1960s and 1970s. And amongst other things, let me have a look here. She was in a couple of the Fu Manchu movies, playing Lin Tang, the ones with Christopher Lee in it. She played the Chinese girl that James Bond sleeps with at the start of You Only Live Twice. And she was actually in Blow Up as well, as a receptionist in Blow Up, the Michelangelo Antonioni film with David Hemming. And more recently and interestingly, she played one of the gamblers in Casino Royale with Daniel Craig, Madame Wu, the gambler who's at the table during all of those great casino scenes, is Tsai Chin. And one of the reasons why she got the gig, of course, apart from the fact that she's a very striking-looking woman, is the fact that she was in You Only Live Twice as well. So she's been in two James Bond films decades apart. But I've gone off on a tangent again, of course, because inevitably that's going to occur with the podcast. The main actor is Edward Judd, who apparently wasn't a particularly nice person in real life, but he did do some good roles in some decent science fiction films. He was the protagonist in The Day the Earth Caught Fire as well. He was in The First Men in the Moon, playing with Lionel Jeffrey, and did a good job with that. One of the things I've noticed in movies, and I'm noticing it more and more, I'm going to talk about it next week when I do Finian's Rainbow, is I'm noticing hair pieces on men in movies, and Edward Judd had one. And in Invasion, it wasn't a bad one. It was fairly reasonable for the time. But I find it a slightly distracting thing at times to look at guys' hair pieces in movies. It kind of lends an artificiality and a unnaturalness to the person's character, the person they're playing, to have them wearing wigs. People in the past haven't been as aware of that as we are now, and wigs, of course, have got a lot better in the 21st century. But it is a kind of small distraction when you're watching a movie to see the guy rocking a rug. But he's good in the role. He did have that certain kind of dramatic intensity. Good actor. I liked him in this one. The movie doesn't actually start with his character, a doctor in a hospital working at night, a guy called Mike Vernon. All of the characters in this are fairly lightly written. It starts out with a man and his girlfriend who are driving along country road at night and hit somebody with their car, an Asian guy wearing a rubber suit. And they reluctantly take him to the casualty ward at the hospital because they're not married and they were off having an assignation. And so there was some kind of, should I or shouldn't I, kind of bits and pieces there. And when he is in the hospital and he's unconscious, they obviously take the x-rays and find that he's got a metal plate in the middle of his brain. They find that his blood pressure starts spiking if he gets cold, if he's not warm enough. And his temperature runs higher than a human. So in common with the predators in the Predator movies, these people are clearly from a warmer planet than England. Two female Alistrians are chasing this guy and come down in another spaceship. And by implication, we find out that they come from a planet which is matriarchal rather than patriarchal, and that women are dominant in that society, because when the male Alistrian regains consciousness, he is a bit shocked when Mike Vernon, the doctor, is giving instructions to a nurse who's a female. So that's another last little bit, having the matriarchal thing here. The script was actually written by a guy called Roger Marshall, based on a script by another guy, because there were a lot of guys in cinema in those days, called Robert Holmes, who did a dozen scripts for Doctor Who back in the old days. And in fact, he kind of adapted the script for Invasion for the first one of the John Pertwee story arcs in Doctor Who, when John Pertwee became the Doctor. I'm not particularly up on old school Doctor Who, and the new ones left me a bit cold these days because it's all a bit magic-y, hand-wavy kind of stuff. And it's a little too... Okay, here's my problem with Doctor Who. Doctor Who is an alien that comes to Earth and rescues the planet repeatedly all the time because we're too stupid and too unnuanced and too ridiculous to do it without the help of a big daddy and, in future, of course, a big mummy from the sky. It's a religious parable, and I'm not that religious. I'm not at all religious, I should say. So to get back to the movie and away from my theological thing, the female Listrians put a force field over the hospital, and the temperature slowly increases in there, and the air starts going bad because that's what happens when you put things in a jar. There's a really nice scene where somebody tries to drive away from the hospital, not knowing there's a force field there, and his little car smashes into something that's not there. And it's a nicely edited sequence because you don't actually see the car hit the invisible barrier. You hear the noise, and they cut from the car heading towards the camera to another shot with the car there with the front smashed in as the driver comes through the windshield because, of course, 1960s, nobody had seatbelts. And it's really effectively done. Because I'm doing a bit of video editing myself, I really appreciate where somebody can give an impression that something's occurring because they don't have the ability to actually make it occur. And of course, the technicians who worked on, even in these low budget films, had decades of experience at doing that kind of stuff. And it works. I actually rewound it to watch that bit again. And it still worked. There's, of course, it's a much simpler thing to do that, sitting behind a keyboard. But as a real practical effect, it was nicely effective and gave us the sense that something beyond human understanding was occurring. There are a few nice character bits in the hospital as things ramp up as well. There are nurses and matrons of nurses kind of handling the fact that they're all trapped there and things are going weird and it's getting hotter and hotter and the air's going bad. There's some problems with some patients and nurses looking after patients. So in some ways, this movie is very much a kind of homage, and it honours the medical profession and what people do to help people, even if they have long hours and it's the middle of the night and things are really going to hell. These people deal with crises on a daily basis, and you do get, in a very nice way, a sense of these medical professionals dealing with something that's even beyond their ability to deal with, but doing it following the mental disciplines they have of handling the things they handle on a daily basis. And I really like that. I like that way that the profession of the people in this circumstance really does make it the movie grounded a little bit in the real world. And for a small film to do that, something I like as a viewer, I like the fact that they bother doing that. If you compare it kind of with a comparable low-budget American movie at the time, the American movie is probably going to be better lit and it's probably filmed in colour. But those little nuances of character don't necessarily happen in a low-budget American science fiction film of 1965, 1966. But in Britain, they kind of, because of maybe it's the acting culture they have there, or had there, they still have it, of course. But they kind of care about character just somewhat differently and with more intensity than the equivalent American version. By the way, I just thought I'd a tangent again, and I'm doing tangents this podcast. There was a thing talking about which British actors win awards. And inevitably, in a lot of cases, in a vast majority of cases, the British actors who win lots of awards, with a couple of exceptions, are British actors who go to private schools and go to expensive schools and have that kind of elite education, because there's a perceptual bias among people who give out awards, and of course people who cast people for movies, that having people from those backgrounds means you're going to get a better quality actor with more discipline and more intelligence and all the rest of it, which is not based in reality at all, but it's something that's happening, and people are really starting to look at that kind of perceptual bias in awards and in casting in films. And that's going to do nothing but good things, I feel, because I know there are a lot of jobbing actors around who don't get opportunities they deserve, sometimes because of their personalities and because of their personal problems, but more often than not because of perceptual bias by the people hiring them. It happens in every other industry. Why the fuck wouldn't it happen in acting? But to get back to this film, I think that the actors they have in this film are really good at what they do. They know who their characters are or their character types because they've played them before. And in a lot of cases, they specialize in a certain type of acting. And it kind of worked for me. I really enjoyed that part of it. And I enjoyed the fact that they bothered making the aliens different in two ways. Their culture is different than ours because they're a matriarchal society. And also the fact that they appear East Asian was a good choice because it shows a broader sense of humanity in a sense where they go, well, maybe the aliens who are human or don't look like white people from the home counties, maybe they do look like Asian people, or though this would never be something they would have done in 1965, having humanoid aliens come down who look like Africans, which of course happened in Brother of Another Planet a couple of decades after this film, would have been a very interesting choice. But I love these little movies that you find now and then that tweak things in interesting ways to show that the people making the production think about them, and that turn a kind of low budget, only having some of the sets at night time and usually not having too long a runtime available to them, because movies like Invasion were second features in double features. So they'd get a big movie for the first one and then put something small but interesting enough to keep the audiences in the cinema for the feature leading into the big feature. And there's an art in that that I really like. I saw any number of B features when I was going to see double features as a kid. And I think that double features are really cool. It turns going to the cinema not just into something you do for a couple of hours when you've got a bit of spare time, but it turns into an event that takes up 4 to 5 hours of your life, which I know people are time poor these days, but I still think that there's a place in the world for a double feature cinema where you can sit down, watch a movie, go take a piss, grab some more food, come back in, watch a second movie, and have a bit of fun with it. It's something I think that should be considered. Maybe that's my perceptual bias happening because I grew up watching double features in cinemas. Just to wind it up for Invasion, good honest little B film. It works within the context of the time it was in. It does some quirky stuff. The spaceship's very small, but that's, again, a budgetary limitation. But they kind of do what they can with what they have to put across what they're trying to tell you in the story and to tell you about these aliens. The movie doesn't have a particularly satisfying ending, but on the other hand, I think, again, those budgetary limitations and the time limitations they were given would be the main reason for that. So I'm saying check it out if you get a chance to. It was released on DVD a couple of years ago by Network, and so you should be able to pick it up if you're inclined to, and I know a lot of you are. You can find it on dubious sources if you want, but I think this one's one of those movies that you want to have in your collection. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I'm going to get back. I'm going to talk about Non, which is a Netflix movie directed by Andrew Niccol, and I like his stuff, even though it's never perfect. I do like his films. And starring Clive Owen and Amanda Seyfried. And it has a beautiful visual style, which I think is very much underappreciated in a lot of the reviews I've seen of this film.
Last night when I was chasing her, that's where it starts. What I see changes. The stairs stretch. It's an optical illusion, which later disappears from my record. And it doesn't end there. At this moment, I'm seeing a train at the platform. A train that isn't there.
Placing a moving image in real time.
Who can hack a human being?
How do we stop this?
To find a hack kit, we hire one.
What can I do for you?
Go
was a blank slate, no digital footprint. She makes her living covering up secrets. She's a master editor who can erase the unwanted act in the record.
Most of all, she erases herself.
And now her clients are getting erased.
This level of anonymizing makes all crime possible.
Anonymity is the enemy.
Someone is killing my customers, trying to make it look like it's me.
She's playing you.
I'm not safe. Neither are you.
We can't believe our eyes. The system doesn't work.
All clear. Please proceed.
You can stay anonymous. Delete everything.
I'm keeping my son's memory alive. What's wrong with her?
You can't look back.
Andrew Niccol, the New Zealand-born writer and director of Anon, is an interesting guy. He's got a good science fiction sensibility. He's only directed 7 feature films. He's done Anon. He did Good Kill with Ethan Hawke, which I haven't seen. He directed a really bad Stephanie Meyer's adaptation called The Host. He did a movie called In Time, the one that had Justin Timberlake in it, and Amanda Seyfried, who's also in Anon. He did Lord of War with Nicolas Cage, which I have fond memories of, but I don't remember too much of the detail. Sim 1 with Al Pacino, about a mad movie director who invents a synthetic female computer simulation that a lot of people think is real, and he plays with the idea of reality versus perception in that. And then, of course, in 1997, he did his first feature film after doing 10 years of TV commercials, which was Gattaca, which is one of the classic science fiction films of the 1990s. Andrew Niccol's a guy who knows what good science fiction is. It's the impact of technology on human beings. It's as simple as that when you pare it down to the bare basics. And Anon is very much about that. It's set in a near future where everybody has cameras in their eyes, basically. In real time, everything they see and hear is uploaded to what they call the ether, which is the version of the cloud, of course. And so there's no crime. They also have augmented reality using the technology, and it's implanted early because we do get one scene where a crime is committed, and one of the viewpoints is through the eyes of a baby who's in the arms of its mother. So either this is done prenatally, it's done by some kind of genetic manipulation, or it's a very not a very intrusive technology. Andrew Niccol then takes us through the implications of this technology. Clive Owen plays Sal Freeland, a police detective who we see first walking down a street, and we see things from his viewpoint. There's a lot of point of view in this film for fairly obvious reasons. And as he walks past people, because he's a cop, everybody's got meta tags on them. He can get a quick précis of who they are, what their age is, what their job is. He looks into a shop window and all the details of the watches pop up. Blank walls on buildings are covered in wireframe advertising, which is designed to draw the eye but not distract. And there's even a scene where he's walking past a couple of Asian guys who are talking in Chinese, I think it is. And a real-time translation pops up in his point of view, telling him exactly what those people are saying in English. So it's a very useful technology, and it's ubiquitous. Everybody has it. There are no exceptions to the rule. Everybody has this technology, and it has a lot of good uses. You can look at an object on a table and get the provenance of it, what it's made of, who made it and when. You can use the technology to unlock the combination lock on your front door. You can pay for goods and services using it just by kind of looking at things in a certain way. It's a little unclear exactly how that part of the technology works, but it effectively does, in a sense, read your mind to find out what you want to do. It could well be something to do with sub-vocalization, but it's a ubiquitous and interesting technology that has some implications for society. For a start, you can't get away with the crime if anybody sees you in any way. That's one strong thing there. The second thing is that the world becomes a very bland place. You don't have to put a TV screen on the wall. You can take a look at it through your augmented reality eyes. You don't need to put paintings on the walls. You don't need to decorate your spaces. Offices become bare desks that people sit at so that they can see virtual screens and talk to people on phones. One of the interesting things is that there are still mirrors, because when you make a phone call to somebody, you stand in front of a mirror and you can see them sitting in front of a mirror through their eyes, and they can see you through your eyes. So you agree to share your feed with that person. And again, there's a certain privacy protection where it's optional for you to give somebody access to your feed and to your back feed as well, because it's all backed up onto the ether. So if your wife says, "What were you doing 2 hours ago?" you can give her your feed and let her see what you were doing 2 hours ago. And this technology is very useful, of course, for the police. And we see a couple of instances. There's one instance where Sal, the character played by Clive Owen, and his boss played by Confiore, are talking to a man who's either his partner or his son commits suicide jumping off a building. And the man insists on seeing what happens to make sure there wasn't anything dodgy going on. And so reluctantly, the cops share the POV of this man walking to the edge of a building, turning off all of the augmented reality and jumping off the building. Now, it's a nice little bit of filming there, and not too hard to do these days when you've got something like a latest generation GoPro, which can do 4K video at 60 frames a second. But it's done nicely, and it's a way of demonstrating the technology. There's another one where a woman claims that the maid in her hotel room stole a bracelet, and we see things through the maid's point of view. We see the things through the woman's point of view, and the woman's convinced by the cops that the maid didn't steal her bracelet. Turns out she did, and the cops are being a bit nice because she sold the bracelet to get food, because obviously there are disadvantaged people in this world. Though with what we see in the movie, we tend to stick with the affluent people in society for the purposes of the story. But there is the implication that there are the haves and the have-nots in the world, but everybody has this technology as a part of their life and a part of the way they see the world. And one of Sal's problems is that his young son died a few years ago because he turned his back on the kid for a moment and the kid accidentally walked out in front of a car. Of course, he feels guilty about that, and he and his wife broke up because of that situation. But because of the way this technology works, he gets very caught up in reviewing the time he spent with his son and re-seeing the moments they shared together, and basically perpetuating the grief and making the grief constantly in the front of his mind, which people are known to do. I know a number of people, well, two or three perhaps, who live in the grief after a partner dies for, in some cases, an inordinate length of time. And it's a kind of self-torture that's very uncomfortable to be around, and Sal's this kind of a person. Now, the next part of the plot is quite interesting. The cops find out, partly through something Sal sees in the street and partly through some murders that don't quite add up, that there are hackers out there who can hack the visual feeds of people, who can cut and paste it, who can paste over one part of a person's lifespan with another. They can take things out that you don't want. They can change the way things are perceived. They can rewrite the visual and audible realities that are uploaded to the ether. And that means that they can get away with murder. They can get away with anything. And in a real sense in this society. They are effectively invisible. So murders take place, and when the point of view of the victims is shown, they find out that the point of view has been hacked, and that what the people are seeing in the last moments is the point of view of the person who shoots them. So they suddenly they're blind to what they can see, and they can only see what the person who shoots them wants them to see, which in this case is a gun pointing at their heads while they're effectively blind and blowing them away. This is of great concern to the police, and what they want to do most of all is to stop it happening at any cost, because while there are hackers out there, then nobody's safe. If the hackers turn vindictive, then people can be killed without any repercussions and driven mad as well, as we find later in the film. So Sal decides that the only way to handle this is to go undercover and to try to find a hacker he saw briefly on the street several days before, which is the Amanda Seyfried character, who's known as the girl. She's a hacker, she's totally anonymous, and she lives off the grid because she can, well, because she can. She deals in cash only from people who hire her to hack things they want to hide from the people around them. And in Clive Owen's character's case, Sal's case, he decides to sleep with a hooker and then get her to remove the memory of that, so that if his girlfriend asks to see what he was doing the night before, he has a clean slate there without a high-priced sex worker as a part of his feed. So the sting operation is very expensive because they've got to do an apartment for him. He's got to spend some time doing his backstory so it looks like he is the high-priced businessman he appears to be. And they kind of really need to add verisimilitude to his feet. Fortunately, the girl, and that's a kind of problematic name, but that's what she's called in the movie, is an ethical hacker. She only looks at the things in someone's feed that they want her to look at as a rule. And so she does the cut and splice on Sal's timeline, and he gets her to do it one more time by buying some cocaine off a guy in the street, and he wants to get rid of that in case the police ever encounter him and he gets in trouble for buying drugs on the street. And because of their mutual attraction, after that second encounter, they have an affair. Sal doesn't think she's part of the murder, but a lot of her ex-clients are being murdered. Of course, inevitably, the girl finds out that Sal's an undercover cop and that he betrayed her, and she starts hacking his memories that are stored and also the things he can see. And it's a very dangerous thing for that to occur, because if you can't see that there's no elevator in the elevator shaft, you're in trouble. If you have a fear of dogs and suddenly someone hacks into your visual cortex and into your ears, the memories, in a sense, of somebody being attacked by a dog, then it gets pretty nightmarish. And indeed, that's what happens. She pays him back for the betrayal. Meanwhile, the cops are hiring hackers to try to trace back her through a whole bunch of proxy servers and find out more about her and see who she is. They eventually hack some of her feed, but because of she's good at what she does, they can't really see where she is, and they can't track her back. So the movie creates a world that's different from ours because of one piece of technology, which is a very complex and a ubiquitous piece of technology. It's like a lot of innovations. It's a useful tool, but tools can be used to do a lot of things. You can build a house using a hammer, or you can beat someone's brains out using it, or you can break their wrist. So this tool is kind of that way. And there is an implication that the world is a bit totalitarian because of this technology, and that dissent of various kinds is impossible. But we don't see any of the political background of this thing, because how much of, say, a politician's feed is backed up to the ether, and how hackable is that, and how much will the politician ask to have their memories and their backed-up memories edited to make them look better. I mean, imagine what kind of editing would be required for somebody like Donald Trump in a world where everything you see and everything you hear is reproducible and transmissible to other people. In a sense, it's kind of a retrograde telepathy in a really interesting way. It's a really nice piece of technology, and the way that it's done in the movie makes a lot of sense. And it's got a lot of the tropes that Andrew Niccol put into Gattaca, for instance. The car designs are retro car designs, but they're electric cars. So he finds some classic European cars that were made in not very large numbers and uses them to populate his world, so it looks kind of retro and noirish while being incredibly futuristic as well. There's a lot of information on the screen at various times during this movie as well, a lot of which you'd have to freeze frame to watch, which is doable, of course. But there's a lot of information about a lot of characters in there. There's a scene where Confiore's character and Clive Owen's character go to a hot dog stand, and all of the bagels and croissants and other things available on the hot dog stand are all meta-tagged. There's the fact that the hot dog has nitrites in it, and Confiore's character shouldn't eat anything that's salty. There's a whole bunch of meta information on the screen, which really is interesting and shows us the world through the eyes of the characters in a way that I haven't seen in other movies. Yeah, there's been a little bit in, say, Minority Report, but it's done in a big splashy Spielberg way where the holograms are all in colour and quite solid. And in this movie, they're all wireframe because you don't want someone to walk into a wall because of an advertising hoarding. So the fact that they wireframe the graphics that you see in the metadata makes a lot of sense. It's a well-thought-out world and a very nuanced world and a very complicated world. And it's one that I'd like to see the movie makers return to, because I think that there is room to find out more about this universe and find out exactly how it works and how they got from here to there. Because I think that it's the kind of technology, it's called Mind's Eye, by the way, which would be repressed rather than embraced by the powerful people in our society. Because where there is no privacy, there is no ability to deceive. And our current society is very much based on the ability to deceive and the ability to tell lies and the ability to spin the truth away from what actually happened in an incident. There are any number of those kind of things going on there, from the Me Too movement, Time's Up, to the vetting of a Supreme Court nominee. There are too many downsides for the rich and powerful for this technology to really get a foothold in the ubiquitous way it does. But Andrew Niccol is about showing us the implications of that world and showing us how having hackers who can hack reality is an enormous problem. And he does it in a good action way. There's some good action sequences in this film. But one of the things that kind of limits it, and I can understand why it was done, and I'll explain why after I tell you what it is that everybody's kind of got a flattened emotional range in this film. Clive Owen's character, Amanda Seyfried's character, Confiore's, a lot of the other actors are playing it slightly flat, and maybe that's an implication that the world has kind of taken something away from human beings while making them safe because of this technology, and making them able to visually remind themselves of how things actually were. Maybe there's something that we don't have any longer in this particular future. That's probably me just justifying the fact that some of the acting is kind of flattened and it's played in a very kind of low-key way. But I think that's the reason why I'm going with that. But that's the downside to the movie for some people, and it's one of the reasons why it doesn't get a very high score on IMDb, for instance. But I think it's a good, solid science fiction movie. I like the fact that Netflix is doing this kind of stuff. And if you want good science fiction that isn't just totally action-based these days, you really don't look at cinema anymore. You don't look at kind of three walls of screen and expensive popcorn. You do get it on the streaming services because they can get a lot of eyes to see it. They can make their money back on the subscription from 100 million people. And they can also show things that are maybe transgressive in the way that Hollywood can't, because Hollywood these days in particular, when it comes to certain sexual themes, for instance, is very conservative. It's careful. It doesn't want to get a certain rating, which is much, much less of a problem with streaming services. So for good science fiction these days, you really do not have to leave the house to see it as soon as it comes out. And that's an interesting change. That's a change over the last 5 years that we've seen. Though we will still go and see tentpole movies and documentaries that we like and smaller films as well. But for the most part, streaming services are inevitably going to take away a lot of the films, the kinds of films that we like, from cinemas. It's inevitable that happens, and I'm not sure where that will end. Maybe it'll end with home delivery of popcorn, though making popcorn yourself is so easy, I can't really see that being a business model. But just to kind of finalise it on and on, I don't think it's a perfect film, as I said. I think that the characters are interesting, but I think maybe Clive Owen isn't bringing his A-game to the acting there. But it's a world that I find really interesting. It follows through the implications of the technological innovations that it proposes, and it's got a visual style that is really, really fascinating and is, in some ways, very unlike anything else I've seen in cinema. And that's kind of cool for me. And I want to see people like Andrew Niccol and Vincenzo Natali and all sorts of other not blockbustery kinds of science fiction writers and directors, but auteur science fiction and genre writers and directors get the chance to make the movies and tell the stories that they want to tell. I want to see those. I want to see them from females who do that. Jennifer Pong. Who did Advantageous in 2015, which I've talked about on the podcast. I want to see her do a whole bunch of new stuff as well. She did she's taken some episodic TV jobs in season one of the Exorcist TV series, but she's got a really clear and an interesting vision as a filmmaker, and I want to see those people make those films. I want to see stories from diverse viewpoints in the genre. Science fiction in literary form is embracing diversity as no other genre is. There are people of colour telling their stories and getting really, really good results. N.K. Jemisin's won the Hugo Award for Best Novel 3 years running for three novels in the same series. And she's a woman of colour, so literary science fiction has embraced diversity and which is one of the reasons why there's a right-wing male rights advocate backlash against it, because the genre and the community of science fiction has gone, right, we want to hear the stories from different viewpoints. We want to hear them from people with different life experiences, different cultural backgrounds, different ethnicities, and different levels of privilege. We want to see all of that. And I think that these kind of movies in Netflix at the start of that's happening in the visual medium, and I've got no problem with that at all. I look forward to it. I look forward to seeing challenging science fiction on a screen. Doesn't matter whether it's a screen in my lounge room or a cinema screen. I want to see that kind of stuff, and I think that it can only work towards increasing the popularity and the longevity of science fiction as a genre. Anyway, that's about it this time. I got through it and I got a bit passionate there towards the end, which is always a good thing. Thank you for listening, and thank you for being part of the podcast, because, whoops, that reminds me, I've got feedback and I haven't even mentioned it yet. I'm going to read you the feedback that I've got over the last few episodes, with apologies to the people who have offered the feedback, because I meant to put it in last time. And I didn't, because I got slack with that. once I've recorded a podcast and I've gone through the intense brain work of talking off the cuff about these things, there are times when I get a little bit tired towards the end of it. But anyway, let me just bring up the feedback. Gary J sent me some feedback, which is great. He also sent a donation, which came through PayPal. So thank you very much for that, Gary. And he says, if I can find them, he'd be interested in my take on the BBC Quatermass miniseries from the 1950s. He has Quatermass 1 and Quatermass in the Pit from the Internet Archive. He finds them better than the films were. By the way, after listening to the episode about Curse of the Fly, I watched it on YouTube. I actually thought it was not that bad, but I was prepared for all its weirdness by listening to the podcast. Thank you, Gary. Yeah, thanks for that, Gary. I will have to visit the Quatermass ones. I do have a paperback of the script of Quatermass 2, which I picked up for free at a book fair. It was in a basket of things they were giving away, and that always draws me like a fly to honey. But, so I really should do that. I'll add it to the list. The list is longer than I'd like it to be honest with you. Then I got another piece of feedback from Nathaniel DeBell. So thank you, Nathaniel. He's just friended me up on Facebook, so great there. Dear Terry, I've been listening to some of your recent podcasts where you discuss your future trip to Japan. You mentioned you are watching Japanese animated series to prepare for the event. I have a recommendation for you, the Japanese animation Red Line from 2009. Red Line is a science fiction racing film which invokes other productions you have discussed on your podcast, like Speed Racer and the awful Death Race 2000. I was incredibly impressed by the film when I first saw it. It has amazing frenetic energy and a distinct style which draws me completely into the production. I think you'd enjoy it. Regards, Nathaniel. Thanks for that, Nathaniel. I'm always up for it. I will definitely find a copy of Red Line and check it out. Though, to be honest with you, I disagree about Death Race 2000. I've got a nostalgic love of it because I saw it on an enormous screen in the State Theatre in Sydney. Now, if people want to Google State Theatre in Sydney, it is the grandest flea pit in the universe. It's a magnificent construction. It's now used for theatrical productions and great big events, but it was used as a kind of B-picture cinema in the 1970s. I always thought that you could do the sword fighting scene from Scaramouche at the State Theatre in Sydney. It's a beautiful place. It's been restored, as has the Capitol down Haymarket in Sydney. And they're both magnificent old flea pits that have been retained and re-engineered to be there for theatrical productions. But because I saw Death Race 2000 at the State Theatre, and because I was very much into the Roger Corman grimy, not too big budget science fiction thing at the time, Nathaniel, I've got a fondness for it. So we'll agree to disagree on that. So thank you for the feedback, both of you. Thank you to the Patreon supporters again, because they are uniquely marvelous human beings. One of the things I will ask everybody who listens is find my YouTube channel and just click subscribe on it for me, because I've got this thing where if I get 100 subscribers, and I'm up to 64, you don't even have to watch the videos, but I prefer you did, of course, but you don't have to watch the videos. But when I get to 100 subscribers, I get a URL with my name on it to use for the YouTube channel so I can promote it better. And for some reason, I really want to do that. So if you're so inclined, and if you're kind enough to do so, click over and find my YouTube channel and just click subscribe, because it will help me get to that 100. And then I can pick the cool URL with my name on it. So on that note of self-promotion, thanks again for listening. As usual, we've got the credits in the style of cinema credits to honour the Patreon supporters. I'll be back next week with Paleo Cinema, where I'll be doing Cabin in the Sky and Finian's Rainbow, and back in 2 weeks with the Martian Driving Podcast. In the meantime, look after yourselves. Take care. Reach out if you need help. If you have the spare resources, help somebody else. Take care of yourselves. I'll be back very soon. And here are the credits. And I will throw some music in afterwards as well. I'll see you later. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Driving Podcast, done in the style of movie credits to honour the people who support this podcast. Thank you to Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Jan, the dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, our wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Richard H, our set photographer, Mark D, our extra, and David L, our extra, Kerry H, who is the accountant, and our newest supporter, Gary J, who is a CG effects technician. So thank you very much to all of the supporters of the podcast. I really appreciate you dipping into your purses and helping out with the podcast.